Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. This week, we're going to take you to jolly old London, England, where we joined the team at Finovate Europe. JP Nichols, Jim Maroos, and I were there to talk the geopolitics of fintech and who's sort of leading the world in this space. But before we get to that, let me take you to Bahrain, where I am this week, to introduce you to Isla Bank, the new neobank or challenger bank emerging with the support of Bank ABC in Bahrain. We are here in Bahrain with Ashley Chancellor, the head of a new digital fintech neobank initiative in Bahrain. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Brett. Pleased to be here.
So tell me, what's different about fintech in Bahrain? Because there seems to be a lot of movement on the regulatory front here.
Yeah, absolutely, Brett. It's been a very exciting journey here. Basically, the market here is moving very, very quickly. As you may or may not know, the Middle East in general is a very fast-growing market in terms of population size. It's a very young market. There's, I think, a high proportion in lots of countries are people under the age of 30, between 60 and 70% in lots of countries, in fact. And we as a business are looking to launch later this year. We're going to go into the market starting here in Bahrain as a regional hub for the Gulf region, and then expand out across the Middle East and North Africa regions, which is a big sort of population markets of Egypt and Jordan and others beside.
So you got lots of regulatory support. So we heard about the launch of ELA, the new neobank, last night at the gala dinner. But how long has it taken you to sort of incubate this, and when do you expect to actually get a product into market or launch into market?
So the journey actually started about just over a year ago now, actually, in terms of its initial thoughts about where to launch, how to launch, what was the best way to go about it. We went through a big process in terms of actually looking really at customer behaviours and customer pain points as opposed to just offering a bank or banking products. And that journey has led to a proposition that's being built. We're initially starting off with a sort of what we're calling and terming a regulatory MVP, which is to get some path to regulation here in the market, and then expanding that out to a more business proposition when we actually go to live to market later on this year.
Now, we obviously at the event, it's sponsored by the bank behind ELA, which is Bank ABC, and you've seemed to have a lot of very high-level senior exec support for that. Has that been important in your ability to sort of get something done?
Oh yeah, massively, Brett. We basically have a supportive immediate board in terms of the immediate bank sort of management board. We have also extended boards in terms of our partners and sister companies, as well as a sort of ecosystem across the we have a very senior advisory board here as well, and as I said, more of our kind of our overall banks board as well is very much behind this project. It's a lot for them. It's about making a big statement to the market, to also obviously an insurance policy for the bank to make sure that we're obviously covering the elements of digital for the rest of the business, but more importantly it's about giving something back to society and to the community, and it's really about helping that sort of financial inclusion model to be able to help the underserved and the unbanked.
Okay, so 5-10 years down the track, what do you hope that ELA has done for the GCC region and for Bank ABC?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, if you look at population numbers, I'll start with that. You know, we're talking about, if you cover the whole of MENA, it's around 380-ish million, I think, at the moment. It's predicted to grow to around 570 by 2025, and I believe around 700 million by 2050. So it's a very fast-growing market. It's a very young market. So, you know, a lot of behaviours that this region is experiencing, a lot of people have never had banking. They don't know anything about this. They don't understand necessarily all the normal stuff that we've had necessarily in the West. So for them, it's a complete entry point. So I would hope hope for ILA, it will be a bank that will grow with our customers, with young people, and also obviously with older people as well, but that they will actually just be part of what they do on a day-to-day basis. It's not something that is seen as a bank or not bank. It's just functionally very helpful, helps them with their, you know, the way that they live their lives and their financial well-being.
All right, so where can people find out a bit more if they want to find out about ILA and your launch plans?
Ooh, that's a good question there, Brett. So we're not really doing too much for the next sort of 2-3 months, and then you'll be able to see us online under illabank.com. At the moment, we're keeping it relatively low key until we get about 3 months before launch, and then we'll kind of do a bigger run. So,
well, thank you, Ash, for joining us on the show today, and continued success with ILA and your efforts here.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having us, Brett.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. We're coming to you live from Europe today, of course. Well, Europe as it stands today, but on March 29th, that's all going to change. We're in London for Finovate Europe, and I have my good friend Greg Palmer with me, but also our regular co-hosts on the show.
All right, JP Nichols.
And Jim Marus.
Okay, so Greg, we thought we'd have a bit of discussion based on the fact that Finovate is sort of this focal point of disruption that's happening in the space. We thought we'd get a bit macro and say, well, we've got Brexit coming up here. We've had Trump in the US, both sort of geopolitical situations, and sort of say, how does this sort of social political movement, how has that affected fintech? And then let's get into some of the specific trends you're seeing out of the show and what's happened this year as well. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, you talk about some of those high-level geopolitical interest points, and obviously I think it's safe to say there's a fair amount of uncertainty at the moment, where there's a lot of kind of wait and see. There's some things we're not sure how they're going to shake out. And that uncertainty is not necessarily an innovator's friend, right? It can be difficult to feel like you're able to build something on shifting sand. And so I think there has been a little bit of freezing of some innovators. But I think what we're seeing now is actually people kind of getting past that, right? I think people are looking towards what you can do. And obviously, at some point, we'll want to have some actual problems to solve, some known problems to solve. But what we've seen, at least at Finovate Europe at this point, are a very wide variety of companies, a wide variety of demos, and people taking some of the technology that's really come to prominence over the last couple of years, things like AI, things like blockchain, and starting to really play with it and say, what can we build with this? What can we do with this? And ultimately, what will probably make the biggest impact will be having a problem to solve, a specific target to shoot for. But I think for right now, it's really fun to sort of see the creativity in the space, see people playing around with some of these tools that haven't been as well known or at least as well understood, and now they're starting to be better understood, and you see them applied in a variety of different directions. So AI is a great example. It's starting to underpin a lot of different technologies. We saw a lot of different solutions on stage here over the last couple days, and it'll be very interesting to see how those companies are able to kind of push forward and adapt as some of the challenges of 2019. You know, we've got this deadline coming up, March 19th. Something will become clear, hopefully, at that point. And the situation in the United States might be slightly slightly longer to wrap up. But I think as we get some bullseyes up in the air there, some of these innovators with these creative solutions will have something to shoot for.
Well, you know, though, I would go back to where you started, and I would see it a little bit differently in that uncertainty actually is the innovator's friend. It's not the incumbent's friend, right? So the incumbents don't like uncertainty. They like predictability, and they want to be able to keep doing what they've always been doing, maybe a little bit better, maybe, some incremental improvement. But it's in times of disruption that the disruptors actually thrive. We saw that 10, 12 years ago, I think, depending on where you say the fintech revolution started, but I'm going to say
2007 when Finovate was launched, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say 2008, plus or minus a year.
It was fairly early in the piece. You guys did well.
Yes.
That bet.
I think one of the other things that comes out of this is the importance of the person as opposed to people. So in a really little obtuse way, when you're really looking at this, the importance of personalization, the importance of collecting data, not just deploying data, the importance of looking at each individual and what their thoughts and thought patterns are, as well as their belief patterns, are going to help know how they invest and how they save and how they manage their financial accounts. I think we saw that how in the U.S. we found with Facebook that upon Trump's election and even beforehand, there's divergence of communities and
tribalism.
And breaking of tribes. Friendships broke off in Facebook because people took different perspectives. Well, what that really is the individual wants to be heard. The individual wants to have their power back, wants their privacy back, wants their security back. And that's a real big opportunity for AI. Now, the challenge right now has been that the financial institutions, while they've been playing with AI, they've been playing with it on an internal basis. So almost all the work we've seen in the reports on the digital banking report has been that a lot of people are more dabbling with it, but we're not seeing the deployment that the consumer can even come close to feeling. So, you know, I continually say we have to move from making better reports to making exceptional experiences, because the consumer is going to demand it. They're getting it from other industries. They just aren't getting it from banking.
That's another trend that you noticed last time we did the live show in New York.
Yeah.
You're talking about customer experience really coming to the fore there. But let's take a macro view here. Obviously, London City has been a real leader in terms of fintech, particularly from the regulatory side. It set the template. We have regulators from the US and other countries in the world coming to the UK to see how the FCA and others are doing that with their sandboxing and their sprints and so forth.
Right.
But who would you say, at a macro level, globally, who's really stood out, from a regulatory, geopolitical perspective in boosting the effectiveness of fintech into market?
As a geography?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, UK for sure, Singapore, Hong Kong. You get to the rest of the Asia and it's a different animal because it's not driven from the regulatory.
Right.
Well, China, we can't have a conversation about the future without talking about China, but I would argue that hadn't been driven by a more progressive regulatory scheme.
Right. It's less regulation.
It's less regulation.
Right. Well, and you see that U.S. wasn't mentioned in any of those conversations. The U.S. still is managed and regulated by old bankers. I mean, you got to be a regulator after you'd finished your banking career.
Now, that was my old joke. Remember that joke?
Right.
When you retire from banking, you don't die immediately, you become a regulator.
Oh, yeah. And you said that, they're coming
over here to see
They're coming over here to see what's going on in the UK. The good news is they're identifiable because they get to board first. The infirm and the elderly, and that's what's happening. And the challenge right now, because we're starting to talk about fintechs moving to the U.S. and possibly try to infiltrate those markets, it's the regulatory environment. They're going to have to find partners because they're going to have to almost restart the whole process without the benefit of the regulators being first and saying, we're opening these opportunities for you.
Well, and one of the issues in the U.S. is the fragmentation of the regulatory scheme, right? We have at least four major national regulators and 50 states, each with their own regulations to some degree. Most of them are superseded by national and a very huge geographic country and powers of influence and knowledge are disrupted between New York and Washington and Silicon Valley and other places. So they've not been able to come together like the city of London or the city-state of Singapore, Hong Kong, right, that have led so far. Very different.
So this is something that came up earlier today as we were talking about the regulatory sandbox that's in play here, which is such a cool concept, and it seems so impossible in many ways to implement something like that in the United States. But it is an amazing venue for regulators and innovators to collaborate, to get together and work together, because I think one of the challenges I'm sure you guys have seen is this breakdown in communication between those two parties. And it was probably 7 or 8 years that we've been running Finovate before we actually had any regulators in the room coming to see what these innovators are working on. And that's where you start to see, their minds are getting blown because they had no idea really what was coming down the pipeline. And the more communication you can have between those two groups, the easier it is on everybody. Now, there are some imperfections with the sandbox as a concept. It's obviously kind of limited to the companies who are able to apply and get selected. So it's not quite open and egalitarian in that way. But as a means of conveying some of these pieces to innovators, it's really an amazing concept. And we've had a couple people on stage earlier today talking about what that allows them to do and how you can kind of proceed with confidence in a way that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily be able to. And it also allows regulators to sort of respond in much more something close to real time to some of the challenges that they see and keep up to date with technology that they see. So it's really, you know, a win-win. While there are imperfections, there are certainly a lot of positives that you can take from that type of environment.
Okay, so let me sort of frame this in a slightly different way. One of the things we saw with Hong Kong, Norman Chan, who's the chairman of the HKMA, he came out specifically when he introduced all those sweeping new fintech regulations back at the end of 2017, December 2017. And he cited Singapore's progressiveness and the fact that they had been reliant in Hong Kong on the incumbents, and that had failed for them, and they'd really been forced into this situation. So why hasn't that happened in the US? Because clearly, the US is falling behind. I mean, if you look at, I've spoken to Valentin from N26, of course, and Moovin, we've been trying to get our charter in the US for some time, and both of us experience that frustration with the fact that the US has just not got anything that is like the fintech charter. So why hasn't the US responded to the pressure of this more progressive fintech movement elsewhere?
Well, I think part of it is the fractionalization, the fragmentation that I mentioned a minute ago. And the other thing is, you know, we're in this terrible state of industries at record profits, and we've got the financial crisis 10 years behind us. Phew, let's not take anything that's too risky on, right? So not feeling the need to change, and that was something Greg mentioned a minute ago too, not feeling that pressure to change is something that works against the status quo.
Jim, well, do you think the U.S. is at risk of sort of losing that status as...
Definitely. But again, it's the government that's getting in the way. And, you know, you visited the White House, I visited the White House, and one of the things they kept on saying was, we've got to stop...
That was a surreal experience, buddy. I'm from Melbourne. A boy grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and to be walking into the White House...
And when they said, how do you get, you know, how can you get to the East Wing? They go, just go down here, go down the steps and go outside. I'm going like, well, what keeps me from going in? They go, we got people. I go, okay,
don't worry, okay. We have that part we figured got out.
But, you know, one of the things they said is we have to stop protecting the infirm organizations, the organizations that aren't... We got 6,000, we got so many institutions that they're answering to, and there's trade associations. That's where the divergence and the fractionalization comes in. But there's so many people that continue to say, the ICBA we talked about yesterday, and all these organizations whose role is to keep it the same. And the challenge is, as it is with the tobacco industry and with the, or used to be the tobacco industry and the gun control, is you have so many people on the other side of the equation that as much as the government wants to say, we've got to let capitalism and competitiveness rule, at the end of the day, they still get ruled by 3,000, 6,000 banks. And what we're going to end up seeing, I think we saw the beginning of it maybe last week, is it may be the middle that gets hurt. The mid-size, bank number.
About the BB&T, SunTrust.
And the bank number 10 to 100 may be more impacted because a bank's already said $250 billion isn't enough. $400 billion gets us to number 6. And, oh, by the way, we have an old-time culture that has to be done. So,
right, but again, as the economics of branches fail, you're going to see much more of this sort of roll-up consolidation because of cost.
And it's tough because the regulators are, on one hand, trying to protect the consumer, and the other hand, trying to protect the smaller banks. And the consumer is basically saying, we need change, but that means probably bigger banks, which right now is not a real friendly positioning to be given the regulatory and the political climate in the U.S.
Well, I want to talk about Brexit in a moment, but let's, while we're in the US, let's talk about Trump's effect on fintech.
Yeah.
Obama's White House, we had Seth Wheeler and then Adrian Harris, who were very progressive advisors to the president on banking. They were responsible for inviting us, Chris Skinner and others, to the White House to have this conversation.
And by the way, just for the record, I was invited. I was already in Singapore, so I couldn't attend.
You were a step ahead.
You should have come, dude. No. But I was not saying that to, big note out of ourselves or whatever. I was just saying, in terms of the progressiveness...
You're giving me FOMO here.
Yeah, well, it was pretty cool. Anyway... I had breakfast in the wardroom. It's next to the Situation Room, right? I mean, it's beneath the Oval Office.
He sat at the White House desk.
It was mind-blowing. Anyway, but the Trump effect.
Yeah.
Now, what has Trump done to fintech?
Well, here's an interesting story. I'm not sure that this necessarily provides a 100% answer to the question, but at Finovate Fall in New York, while we were there coming into town, was the day that the New York regulators were basically in the process of denying the bank charters for several fintechs. So you think this was, we're here this celebrating. Where
the New York Fed launched a federal case against the OCC that sponsored the fintech charter.
Yes. Yeah. So they say, no, you can't grant it for everybody. We have the right to deny. And of course, you know, you can answer the question, where are they getting their marching orders from? Any number of different ways. But it was a really interesting juxtaposition to what we had going on in the room at Finovate, where you've got this amazing innovative atmosphere, and then you've got sort of this old guard sort of saying, no, we're going to protect it.
Uh-oh.
Now. And I think if you look at that's not a federal board, right? That's not anything that would have to do with Trump, but it is sort of symbolic of that environment that I think is being cultivated at the moment. And so, you know, this is what we're talking about. When you have that uncertainty, if I build something, am I going to get to a certain level and just get smacked down? Or will I be allowed to actually prosper? Will I be allowed to compete at an even playing field? And I think that's where, you know, you hear different takes on obviously a variety of things, but I think that's one of the biggest impacts that the regulation can have, and the lack of guidance can also have this, you know, crippling effect. If I don't feel like I can get to the top of the pile, then I might not try.
And obviously, since that time, we have seen no fintech charters issued in the U.S. So, yeah. it's been an issue.
Well, part of the current administration's point of view seems to be towards deregulation again, right? They've wanted to unfund the CFPB, the Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau, and, you know, strip the funding of that and make some of the other changes that they've had there. So moving towards deregulation might be a tailwind for fintech. But however, given the nature of what we're talking about here, and the other thing that's happened in the current administration the last few years is the lobbyists have never been more powerful. So, and there is not a cohesive, effective fintech lobby. There's a very cohesive, effective bankers lobby.
Right. And there's a lot of talk about level playing field in the U.S., but the problem with the concept of a level playing field when it comes to fintech bank charters is the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, which effectively still is the only mechanism for financial inclusion, evidently failing in the U.S. right now, but that mandates banks keep their branches.
In other words, we don't think you're serving the community unless you have branches.
And we saw the effect of that last week, because CRA is probably a big reason why you had the merger of organizations that really overlaps significantly. In the past, mergers were usually done to expand your footprint. This was really done, one of the major reasons was to have the overlap, because that way you didn't have to get government approval for the fact that I want to close a branch that's right next door to my branch or across the street from my branch. But you also had the situation with the Trump era that you had a business tax break. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, this will be reinvested back into innovation and all this. Well, the reality is it's extended again the bank's string of profits that started when they started giving breaks in 2008. And what's happened is we've had a lot of fictitious growth in earnings that has not been done by typical banking. They've been done by taxes. They've been done by loan reserves. There have been all these things that prop up the industry so that you don't have to innovate. Because what's happened is, as you said earlier, JP, is why should I prop something up if it's already going well?
Yeah. Why should I reinvest and
exactly.
risk disrupting myself?
I'm not feeling pain.
Right.
Well, this is one of the fascinating things, coming back to the point about, you know, the current sort of fintech boom. The fintech boom, as we know it, has essentially only existed sort of since the Great Recession. And so it's been kind of, you know, 10 years of more or less boom times. And so we haven't seen what a little bit of stress does to the market. We've sort of been on the one side, you've got these amazing capabilities. You're seeing innovators who can do more and more incredible things. But I mean, and this is something that, JP, I know you talk about all the time. There's not necessarily this motivation on the part of financial institutions to really adopt that. There's nothing that's sort of forcing them to go out and take some of this cool technology and bring it into their stack. Obviously, if things are going well, why rock the boat? So does the industry need a little bit of pain, or maybe the threat of a little bit of pain, in order to kind of move to the next level, kind of getting knocked off that comfortable perch?
So, you know, one of the areas where we see real differentiation right now is not only in the FinTech Charter, but in what's happening with mobile payments. So in Europe, you've had some mandating of the mobile payments architecture, which has moved things along. But the real interesting thing is China, of course. Alipay, and, you know, here we are at Finovate today. Of course, Ant Financial has just announced the acquisition of World Remit, or what is it? Well, I can't remember the name.
Hey, man, I've been busy. Don't look
you
at me.
Guys.
World First.
Thank
World
you.
First, yeah.
I just had a brain fart. So, and so that means, you know, $700 million acquisition, and but that extends Ant Financial's footprint well out of China. They're already in 100 countries, but those two companies, Tencent WeChat and Ant Financial, did almost $22 trillion in mobile payments through their ecosystem last year. That's more than all of the card schemes in the world, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, et cetera. So that's incredible to see the growth they've had. US did $30 billion right. of mobile payments. I mean, not even in the same universe.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is why I like to sort of say that the US is sort of 7 to 10 years behind China on this right now. I mean, 11th of 11th, you know, Singles Day last year in China, they had $31 billion in sales for this one day, but 60% of those transactions were done using biometric authentication. No signature, no chip and PIN, you know, facial recognition.
Right.
Now, if you said, what's it going to take to get the Visa and MasterCard card schemes, and essentially these are US companies, to be able to authenticate using facial recognition, I didn't even know how we would get there.
Right. Well, this is the problem. This is the hurdle of the incumbents, right? The incumbent schemes, the incumbent companies, the incumbent processes and products and everything. And they all work reasonably well enough. They're not so broken that we need to throw them into the trash and start with something new, where China had that luxury of being able to leapfrog
right.
all those legacy technologies and business models and really jump to something new.
Can I just interject here? This might be an unusual perspective, but I recently had to write a paper check for the first time in what felt like a year.
Yeah, Mike.
And I was sort of struck by the, like, I can't believe the system ever worked. Right, a paper check. I was like, here I am, like, I rip off a piece of paper, I, like, write some numbers down, and all of a sudden this is money? Like, this is an incredibly bizarre system. And yet, you know, when I needed to get money from, that my mom owed me to me, the fastest way by wide margin was for her to just write out a check and I take a picture of it. Like, I can't believe I've worked in fintech for 10 years and I'm still asking for somebody to write me a paper check because that's the fastest solution.
Yeah, people tell me all the time in the US it's faster to write themselves a check to transfer money than ACH.
Yeah. Well, that's me. I mean, that's my situation. I never wrote a check for like 5 years and then I have a small business and to transfer money from my small business to my personal account, it was easier for me to write a check twice a month for the same amount, take a picture of it, because the two banks, which are very large banks, don't talk well. They don't play well together. And then it's the same situation where one of my business bank has a mobile deposit capture limit of $5,000 a month for everybody. And I said, well, why is that? They said, it's a risk thing.
It's for your protection, sir.
Yeah, it's for a risk thing. And I said, so you give only $2,000 loans for cars. You know, is that the only limit you give? And on the other hand, my other bank, the personal bank I have less money in, has a $75,000 limit. I could say there's some bizarreness to that as well. But you go, they get in their own way too much. You know, and what's happening is, even without the banks knowing it, the consumer is outplacing them. So my business account, I think I told you that my business, if somebody asks me where my business account is right now, it's really with PayPal.
Yeah.
Because I get all my money through credit card payments and it goes to PayPal. I pay all my vendors through PayPal. I transfer money a couple times a month from my PayPal account to my bank. So my bank, in their minds, if they don't do any homework, they think everything's normal. But they don't have to look very far to see, wait, all that money's come from PayPal. And the only thing we're getting in directly are wire transfers. So in effect, the bank is simply a utility to me. PayPal is also offering me loans for my business that PNC, or the bank that I'm working with, doesn't know. Well, there we go.
That's out of the bag now.
Yeah, and the radio audience as well. But they don't.
The show is brought to you by PNC Bank.
But the challenge is, it's more difficult to work that way. And so you find better ways to work. And you know, what's interesting is PayPal right now is a better idea of what my business makes, what it does, how much money comes in, because they're handling all the payments. So of course they're going to say, we have you already approved, because they have all the information available.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Tune in to the Voice America Variety channel on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Voice America Variety broadcasts a diverse array of topics, reaching a global community. Our experts come from all walks of life, and the topics they discuss are everything from current events, arts and entertainment, leadership, parenting, relationships, self-improvement, career advice, and a variety of other topics. Check us out today. You're sure to find something of interest. Voice America Variety. Talk on today's hot topics.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Now, I will say, just to put a quick plug, Finovate alum Venmo is actually one who does seem to be kind of making that leap, getting that adoption. And I knew they were picking up when my yoga teacher actually asked me to pay in Venmo. And we can just gloss right over the part, by the way, where I admitted to doing yoga in live radio as well. But that was a big deal for me because she was like, do you have Venmo? And I'm like, Do you know what that is? So that's one where, and that's a kind of a level of adoption that I hadn't seen with most of the solutions that we see on the Finovate stage. And that's the real hurdle, isn't it? Getting it actually out of this type of environment and into the real community, getting that adoption. Because as you know, Alipay and Tencent have shown, once you start to build critical mass, it becomes easier and easier to pull more people in. The system gets more robust. So you know, can someone like Venmo get to that level, get to that point where people really do use it as a verb and say, will you Venmo me the money? Maybe. I think it's already there.
But this is the capitalism argument that the United States has. This is how they perceive innovation. But clearly, China has innovated more rapidly in this respect. So that's the challenge, right?
Is it a better product, though, or does it just have more people?
Well, no, I think if you look at why Alipay and WeChat has done so well in China, it's not just the fact they had they didn't have the embedded behavior around checks and plastic to circumvent. They had network effect of the largest e-commerce platform and the largest social network.
Clearly.
So that network effect was phenomenal. And it started with things like the red packet at Chinese New Year. But how many of you guys, I don't know if it's going to work well on radio, but how many of you guys have actually written a check in the last 12 months? Anyone? One, two, three, there's not many. How many of you have used PayPal or something similar in the last 12 months? Everyone.
Oh, everybody. Okay. And see, this is what happens is, this is not just a banker audience, but it would come out the same no matter where you do it.
Right.
I am in a similar kind of survey. I had 500 community bankers in a room, and I said, how many of you have Amazon Prime? And every single banker raised their hand. I then said, how many of you, when Amazon raised their prices by $20, 20%, how many of you considered at least closing out your Amazon Prime account? Two people in an audience of 500 raised their hands. Now, what that tells you is two things. Number one, it's no longer free shipping, so that's not why they're doing it. But what they're doing is the application of AI, personalization, everything that Amazon does, people now are more entrusting of Amazon than their bank. You couldn't have people raise their hands about almost anything else and get that kind of universe. Now, what's also interesting is Amazon realizes you pay for value. So the banking industry continues to say, when we talk about AI, the conversation very quickly gets to how much can I sell, how much can I cross-sell, as opposed to, with this information, how much can I advise somebody on possibly buying? And the problem is the banking industry continually falls into old ways, saying that they want to push product as opposed to giving service. And you know what Amazon does now is very subtle. So they know what kind of price point you like. They know what kind of colors you like. And so they push to the top the price points. They push, you know, if I go shopping for a book right now, they realize I've probably bought only two digital books. I like the hardcover. They put that front and center. Now, my wife likes the digital books on tape. She gets a completely different answer to the exact same question because of the personalization. They know what I'm going to be doing from a price value standpoint. And again, this is the potential. The challenge is we all are talking a great game. We're not implementing it for the customer's benefit. And there's the startups, again, that are making headways, and the big techs.
As an aside, if you put your birth year down as 1919 everywhere you fill it out, you get some amazing ads and product recommendations. I wholeheartedly recommend that as a concept, just to experiment to see what happens.
Well, we do have to have a quick break here, and so we'll take you to break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We're coming to you sort of live from London, United Kingdom. We're live. We are alive from the United Kingdom, and we'll be back right after these words from our sponsors. Sorry, guys, we have to do
this. Be kind of like the Trevor and Noah behind the scenes. We can talk about things that, you know,
do you want to bring us
ask
back?
Some questions
sure.
to the audience.
All right, the good news is we don't have to wait any particular point in time. We'll just cut the audio and say
5, 4.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. So JP Nichols and Brett King here along with Greg Palmer from Finovate and Jim Marus. And we're talking about the future of fintech. And where we left off, Jim, you were talking about how the banks in particular, the incumbents, are too slow at coming up with these. And you talked about being at a conference. I'll tell you one that I did accidentally a year and a half ago. I was in an audience full of bankers.
How do you do it at a conference accidentally?
I was going to ask that same question.
Well, I wasn't at the conference
accidentally. He was in the hotel. He was in the hotel with his wife.
The question I asked, I didn't realize that it would be one I would continue to ask, right? I just kind of randomly, and we were talking about voice. And I said, you know, how many people in the room are using voice daily? Yeah. And we can do that again if you want. Do you use your device, or do you have a device at home where you're using voice as an interface?
Siri,
you
know,
a lot of you, yes, Siri, yeah. Or any of that.
Yeah.
Not as much here, but a good 80% of the hands went up in the room. And then it was all banks. It was a banking association meeting. And I said, well, how many of you are working on it? Two hands in the whole room went up. And it caused me to say, well, let me do that again. How many of you use voice? All these hands went up. How many are working on voice? No hands went up. I said, well, there you go. But please pay a consulting fee because I just gave you your next project, right? So it takes us a long time to understand what these trends are and really sink in because we to your point, we can't figure out how to make money on it. So we'll just wait until we do.
Well, I think it's somewhat interesting too. You now have, I think, three of the big eight banks in the U.S. that right now have set up digital-only banks. Mm-hmm. And what that's actually saying is we can't get enough customers to use digital the way we're building it because it's kind of like a new access point but the old system, that they're restarting with completely digital-only banks as separate units. Well, I know...
So that's Citibank with their yet unnamed neobank.
Right.
Finn, which is Chase's out of footprint fintech, if you like, because they don't compete with branches, and
Wells.
Greenhouse from Wells.
And you have Wells.
Yeah.
And
Marcus from Goldman Sachs, if you want to count that. Yeah.
I now know of two additional banks in those that are working on the projects directly, and I'm saying that 8 out of the top 10 by the end of this year are going to have digital-only banks. Now, what that says is, okay, now what other banks are big enough to actually create a digital-only unit, but they're also admitting defeat. They're saying that they can't get their own teams to work together, getting out of the banker's mode, because, you know, we all know Mikhail from he used to be from M-Bank, and he talked about how they built the M-Bank the mobile lending platform that can get an answer in 15 seconds, and he point blank said, we got people around the table and said, do it. Well, what's interesting in the U.S., they can't get out of their own heads to say, we'll build something without having the political view of saying, I'd like to build something, but I'll do everything you talk about except for that one thing that may cost me my job.
Right.
And so the inability to disrupt themselves for the better good and the holding on to successes of the past that really end up being the hindrance for all of us. I mean, if you're successful, if the banks are, why change anything?
But this is why I like that. Model that you just described, and I think, you know, Mikhail did it quite well at M-Bank quite a while ago, maybe the first that I know of to do that.
And he introduced it at Finovate.
Yeah.
Right. Yep, there we go.
Because you can challenge yourself and not have to have to threaten the status quo, right? So you appeal to a certain set of customers, but you have a probably 90% cost advantage in that other platform. Right. And over time, as you bleed more and more over to that thing, then you can make a different decision with the economics that you have in your legacy platform.
Well, and then the question gets, do the people around the table say, okay, I can see where this is going. I'm going to start working on being one of those other people that are better off. But that's not what happens. They go, hey, we got a pretty good fiefdom here. I won't lose, which is why if you talk to a bank and have to figure out something from the checking account side of the business, you're going to have to go through four or five different department heads to get something solved. On the other hand, my other bank said on a lost debit card, they said, oh, but by the way, your Apple Pay is already set up and you can use it getting out of the parking garage I was in at that point. So I'm saying, you see that one part of the bank gets it. Mm-hmm. The other side of the bank is protective of their fiefdoms.
So let's take that back to where Greg went, thinking about, you know, look, we're 10 years into the expansion. There's another retraction of some length, of some depth at some point before too long. So Brett, what do you think? Is a recession good or bad for fintech?
Well, you know, it presents opportunities, particularly with lower economics, which is, I do think that in respect to the digital brands that you're talking about and the BB&T SunTrust, you know, this is, they're both symptomatic of the fact that those who are in the know have already worked out that the economics of banking is fundamentally changing. Mm-hmm. And that you're going to have to be digitally acquisition focused to survive this. And I think I think the pressure of the neobanks here in the UK has produced the same realization that if these companies like Monzo, Starling, N26, Revolut, yep. if they can acquire customers at scale at a far lower cost, it's going to be only a matter of time before the market says, what are you doing with all these branches acquiring customers at 50 times the price? So I think that's the sort of framework that to put it in. So if a recession happens, there's increased pressure on the operational side of the business, and I think fintechs can show some sort of exceptional capabilities in that respect. So, but having said that, funding also dries up. Now, the problem we've got with a lot of these big fintechs right now is that they rely on new funding rounds. Mm-hmm. That's not unusual. Twitter did it for many, many years. You know, yeah. Amazon didn't post a profit for, 20 years? And so it seems to be the way many of the VCs are operating these days, trading growth and scale for ongoing capital. But at some point, you know, maybe in a recession, that capital might dry up.
And yeah, so it's not unlimited.
Yeah.
Well, my question to you, both of you then, or all three of you, is, okay, so you have a situation where we keep on thinking of it in the terms of the bank, okay? Isn't it not possible that an Amazon or a Facebook or a PayPal says, we don't want it all, but, you know, Amazon may say, you know what, I can do a checking account customer or something that looks like this, without becoming a bank. I
can we're already
partnership
there.
And everything else.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, are we continually thinking things in the framework of what we have, as opposed to thinking it doesn't matter? Because if consumers' trust right now is higher for Amazon than any of the banking industry's banks, which it is.
And the same in China with Apple Pay and WeChat.
And if you don't want to take the ramp up for some of the fintechs from the UK and the United States, why isn't there the opportunity to say, you know what? We just have to think about it differently. Why doesn't one of these major big tech companies say, I'm just going to take lending, or I'm just going to take deposits or savings or investment services, and I don't have to bring it all together?
This is a key point, because often, you know, when I would have a debate with an existing banker, often the argument be, well, you're not a real bank as a challenger. Right. You're not a real bank, because you can't offer mortgages.
And therefore what?
Yeah. But actually, if you think about, you know, and Finovate is a good illustration of this, the way we're evolving the ecosystem for retail financial services, day-to-day banking, is much more like the app world that you have on your phone. You know, you don't have one app that does everything on your phone. You know, you don't go to Uber and expect them to do all of your travel, including air travel and hotel bookings, things like that, because they're good at the car stuff, you know. So, and I think that's the way people are starting to think about financial services now. Oh, I need to buy a home. Where can I go to get that functionality or that utility? And so that the days of the universal retail bank, I think the technology shift that we're seeing is also the end of that universal banking model. Because, you know, carrying that cost of that full service bank, it's even harder to make the economics of that to work just being a community bank with a set of branches, you know, I believe.
And a geographic boundary.
And this is something that comes up quite a bit at Finovate as well, this sort of trend of kind of build a bank, right? Like I as a consumer can pick and choose services and build my own bank from different people. And the question is, you know, what do you want to own as a bank? Which piece do you want to own? Do you want that relationship with the customer? Do you want to be the place where they log in to access all the other services? You know, have the API suite that you're running be the one that's directing them. My investment is here, my checking is here, I'm using this other app to pay. Is that relationship what's valuable, or is it actually the end service that's valuable? And I think the answer is still up in the air. But I just want to come back to something earlier, talking about one of the, I hesitate to say kind of benefits of recession for fintech, but I think there was something that we saw very early on in the days of Finovate. We saw this kind of coder plus banker team, where somebody who just sort of left a bank knew the operations and knew the inefficiencies very well, partnered with someone on the development side and could build something. And I wonder if we... Solving a problem. And I wonder if you see something where we'll have somebody with that kind of knowledge base that I've been inside a bank, I understand how it works. Because what we've seen is there's frequently this disconnect between kind of the tech side and the finance side. We kind of talked about it earlier on the regulatory environment. A lot of the tech players sometimes underestimate how big of a hurdle some of those regulations can be. And having some of that knowledge get dumped into the market, if you know there's a recession, banks start offering incentive plans for executives to retire, all of a sudden you've got these people with capital, with inside knowledge of the industry, who are able to say, hey, I think I can build something up here and bring something to market that might actually have a chance of competing with the organization that I just left because I know them
well. Let me throw it back to you in a different way. Who's the fastest growing financial services organization in the world today?
Morgan Stanley? Alipay?
I'd say Ant Financial. Alipay.
Yeah.
Who's the fastest growing international remittance business? TransferWise? Probably,
yeah.
Right? Who's the fastest growing, if you continue that line of thought...
I wasn't told there was going to be a test today.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, come on, this is day three for me, man. I'm right of here.
My point is that if you look at the core growth that's happening in financial services today, where we're going to be in 20 years' time, the technology players who have that scalability. Remember Jack Ma at the World Economic Forum talking about Alibaba versus Walmart, and he said, you know, if Walmart wants 10,000 customers, they need a new branch, new warehouse, new stores, this
new
and
trucks.
That. For me, two servers, right? Two computers. So that sort of scalability of tech is key. So then coming back to your question, I don't know if knowledge of bank regulation is actually going to be fungible for much longer, because ultimately you're going to have to be a technology company to compete.
Mm. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, we talk about regulations a lot. The one that really hangs up regulators is the safety and soundness, and particularly in the U.S. where we have insured deposits. It's really all about safeguarding your institution, safeguarding those deposits, because we don't want to dip into the federal coffers to pay out depositors if your risky bet doesn't pay off. Outside of that...
Because the Fed doesn't have much money.
Yeah. We already tried a bailout, and that was super popular.
Yeah.
But outside of that... Right, everything else can be solved outside of the banking system.
Yeah.
And so, Greg, I'd say two things that resonated to me from the question you posited. And the first is around this idea of people that are now freed to go and actually solve a problem. I think that's an awesome thing that we could definitely see during a recessionary cycle, is people, maybe didn't plan to become an entrepreneur, but they don't have the bank job anymore. And if they're smart about solving the problem, that's great. And then the flip side of that coin, Brett, is exactly what you said, though. If that's embedded in a framework of this is how we do things in a highly regulated institution, and this is, you know, the committees that we need to set up in order to approve this, probably not so successful. So one stat, and I have no idea the answer to this, but there's a rhetorical question, but if we go back and look at the most successful fintechs, so let's go through the unicorn list, you know, how many of those have ex-bankers as a part of the team? I don't know.
Yeah. All right, well, we did promise we were going to talk about Brexit.
I was just going to say, this so far has unfolded like a lot of my conversations this week with the promise of talking about Brexit and then not really much desire to actually engage and
let's,
do it.
Let's get at it. We've got Brexit coming up. Whether it's going to be it increasingly looks like a hard Brexit, although, you know, we'll see. If I understand it correctly,
it's a no-deal hard Brexit.
Yeah, no-deal hard
Brexit. So I have to have a whole new 2x2 matrix, the deal, no-deal, hard, soft. Yeah.
So here's my question. You know, the FinTech Charter mechanism that we've seen so successful in the UK, does the Brexit give that less teeth? Because was there an attractiveness to starting a FinTech Charter here in the UK and having the KYC passporting possibilities and the EU access? And is that going to affect the growth potential of the likes of Monzo and Starling potentially? What do you guys think?
Well, I think we have already. Haven't we seen some of these companies opening offices in Belgium and in Germany and other places like that? So I suspect that, yeah, if part of the call for being in the UK is we're also a part of the EU and we have clear access to all that, and suddenly we don't. That seems fairly clear to me.
Do you think it will affect investment in the UK in fintech?
I mean, I don't know about investment, but I think the talent side of things will certainly be affected, because obviously one of the most crucial pieces of fintech development is the developer.
Right.
And so, you know, London as a place has been very attractive for a lot of fintechs because you could pull talent from all over.
But there's not a lot of homegrown.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say. I don't know as much, but certainly you don't want to limit the talent pool that's available to you, right? Because you don't know where that next great coder is going to come from. And so you look at who they could potentially pull from, who's already here. You know, there's some obviously amazing talent here, but that's I think my biggest concern is, you know, are they going to be able to stay competitive with other regions which can attract whatever talent they want from all over?
Well, the results of the H-1B pressure in the U.S. has dramatically pushed up, salaries for the available resources in the U.S. It hasn't solved the fact that there's not enough STEM programs in the U.S. to replace the H-1B visas. These are the technology-based resources coming from regions like India and so forth into the market.
It's thrown a huge wrench into those who would prefer much, much tighter immigration in the U.S. to realize, well, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of people we need to bring in.
But we're you know, it's interesting. The U.S. has got the borders based on the oceans and the top and the bottom a lot more than the UK does. So you have a situation where jumping across a border isn't that. But we're seeing it already in the States. The battle
between
states.
There are people that have swum the English channel.
Yes, they have. But we see it in the States with the competitiveness for talent again. And you're getting these tech hubs that are taxed that way. So what happens is there's incentives. There's some states that don't charge an income tax. There's some states that have the universities. There's the benefits from different areas. So I think we're going to see it in a micro way, but I think it's going to affect the United States less than Brexit.
So fintech, Brexit, winners and losers. Who gets benefit from the Brexit and who doesn't?
I think you look at Singapore as obviously getting some benefit from it. I think a lot of the companies who are kind of establishing headquarters elsewhere are looking at that type of city, which is obviously very open and very intent on fostering innovation. So you see that happening where people are looking at that's a great place to at least have a kind of a nominal home base, which you can then obviously have offices elsewhere. I think the Asian market probably does benefit. I think there are also a number of places in continental Europe that will pick up some of that slack. You know, we've seen one of my favorite things about fintech Europe is
aggressively gone after sort of becoming the fintech hub of Europe.
Fintech Europe, what was it, 2017, we saw a lot of Germans with smiles on their faces as they walked around here in London. So that is...
very good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I mean, it's one of those situations where are the consumers? Where is the talent? Where is the investment? Where's that kind of perfect storm, all those pieces that you need to kind of create that unicorn. And I look at, you know, Asia is probably soaking up a lot of that, and obviously continental Europe as well.
So on a net-net basis, do you think Brexit will be good or bad for fintech in the UK?
I'd say bad.
I'd say bad.
Jim?
I'm going to say good.
Really?
Just because we both said bad?
No, I'm actually saying good because I think it gets back to some of the things were said earlier. When there's a brand new environment, startups tend to do very well because they can quickly respond to market changes. So is it going to be good for the existing fintechs? Maybe not. But will there be brand new ones? Because the innovative cycle, I think you've seen and you all see, has ramped up. I mean, there's no lack of talent, and the entry cost of entry has gone down so much. If there's an opportunity, look how quickly the neotechs and the challenger banks grew in this marketplace when the regulations changed. Immediately. I think things can happen. So I think it's good news.
Okay, well, we've only got a couple of minutes left. So we should do a quick wrap-up. You know, what were the highlights of Finovate for you this week, Greg?
Man, so there were a lot of great demos to choose from. I think one of my favorites was Voca AI with their amazing voice activation piece, which just sounded so incredible when you watched the demo. It's you had me wondering how long before you could just actually have your first 100% AI demo. When do you actually stop needing people on stage to actually demo the product? You can just put a recording up there, put the machine up there and say, okay, there you go, have at it. So I thought that was a really good one, and they did end up winning Best of Show. I also really enjoyed just kind of the diversity that we saw here today, you know, that kind of creative aspect to it, a lot of people trying things in different areas. And I'm going to give a little plug to the UX design agency, just a very pretty platform, the kind of thing that you look at and say, that is just pleasant. I would like to use that. So, you know,
it was functionally good. I mean, I'm familiar with the agency, and I thought, I don't think there's ever been a Finovate show where design agency showed their innovations as a way, like a platform, and to make sure that every banker remembers that, by the way, you still got to make this thing work. And they didn't put a soft shoe on the fact that your back office got to be better than your front, but they're making it so that it's as easy as Amazon or as easy as Venmo to do banking. They gave some really good examples, but I think it's unique in itself that it opened up a brand new area of innovation that hasn't been seen at the Finovate before, so I think there's some good news there.
On the flip side, I have to say, we had a new record at this Finovate. Creologix won Best of Show and broke their trophy within 20 seconds of receiving it. So that was also, I wouldn't go so far as to say my favorite
they
moment, but
Will
it was, yes, that was a
irrational
fascinating
exuberance.
One. Yeah, it was a shatter.
Now they can prove they got 7 trophies at Finovate.
Very good.
It was way more than 7
pieces. 7 and a half.
7, yeah, all on the ground.
Well, that's it for Breaking Banks this week. Thank you for joining us from Finovate Europe in London, the United Kingdom. Thank you to Jim Maroos for joining us again. I always do that. And JP Nichols, my longstanding co-host, and Greg Palmer.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm Brett King. You've been listening to Breaking Banks, and we look forward to you joining us next week for more adventures in the land of fintech. Thank you.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.